hair. She watched his face, only his face, as Spielman eyed Raboy and Litvak. She was tender as an engineer looking for cracks, fatigue in the material. It seemed inconceivable that they had known each other, as far as Litvak was aware, for slightly under 3 hours. 3 hours. That was all it had taken for her to seal up her fate with his. "Welcome," Dr. Raboy said, posed beside a wheelchair with his necktie flapping in the breeze. Gold and Turtletoib, a Sitka boy, jumped down from the plane to the dock, Turtletoib heavy enough to make it ring like a slammed telephone. The water smacked the pilings. The air smelled of rotten netting and brackish puddles in the bottoms of old boats. It was almost dark, and they all looked vaguely green in the light of the floods on the standards, except for Spielman, who looked white as a feather and as hollow.
"You are genuinely welcome."
"You didn't need to send an airplane," Spielman said. He had a wry, actorish voice, his diction studied, excellent, with a low, soft underthrob of the sorrowful Ukraine. "I'm perfectly capable of flying on my own."
"Yes, well."
X-ray vision. Bulletproof. The whole bit. "Who was the wheelchair for? Me?" He outspread his arms, laid his feet primly side by side, and gave himself a slow once-over, looking prepared to be shocked at what he found. Ill-fitting, pinstriped suit. Hatless. Tie loosely knotted, one shirt tail hanging out. Something teenage in his unruly ginger curls. Impossible to see in that slender, fragile frame, that sleepy face, any hint of the monstrous father. Or maybe a little around the eyes. Spielman turned to the pilot, affecting to be surprised, even hurt, by the implication that he was so far gone as to need a wheelchair. But Litvak saw that he was putting it on to cover his real surprise, and hurt, at the implication. "You said I looked all right, Miss Lantzman," Spielman said, teasing her, appealing to her, pleading with her. "You look terrific, kid," the Lantzman told him. She was dressed in blue jeans tucked into high black boots, a man's white Oxford shirt, an old Sitka Central firing range jacket that said Lantzman over the pocket. "You look fabulous." "Ah, you're lying, you liar." "You look like $3,500 to me, Spielman," the Lantzman said, not unkindly. "How about we leave it at that?"
"I won't be needing the wheelchair, doctor," Spielman said without reproach. "But thank you for thinking of me."
"Are you ready, Mendel?"
Dr. Raboy asked him in his gentle and sententious way.
"Do I need to be ready?" Mendel said. "If I need to be ready, we may have to push this back a few weeks."
The words emerged from Litvak's throat like a kind of verbal dust devil, a tangle of grit and gusts, unbidden. An awful sound, like a glob of burning rubber plunged into a bucket of ice.
"You don't need to be ready," Litvak said. "You only need to be here."
They all looked shocked, horrified, even Gold, who happily could have read a comic book by the light of a burning man. Spielman turned slowly, a smile tucked into one corner of his mouth like a baby carried on the hip. "Alter Litvak, I presume," he said, holding out his hand, scowling at Litvak, affecting to be tough and masculine in a way that mocked toughness and masculinity and his own relative lack of both qualities.
"What a grip, oi, it's like a rock."
His own grip was soft, warm, not quite dry, eternally a schoolboy's. Something in Litvak resisted it, the warmth and softness of it. He was himself horrified by the pterosaur echo of his own voice, by the fact that he had spoken at all. He was horrified to see that there was something about Mendel Spielman, about his puffy face and his bad suit, his kid prodigy smile and his brave attempt to hide the fact that he was afraid, that had prompted Litvak, for the first time in years, to speak. Litvak knew that charisma was a real-life, if indefinable, quality, a chemical fire that certain half-fortunate men gave off. Like any fire or talent, it was amoral, unconnected to goodness or wickedness, power or usefulness or strength. He felt, shaking Spielman's hot hand, how sound his tactics were. If Raboy could get Spielman up and running again, then Spielman could inspire and lead not merely a few hundred armed believers or 30,000 black-hatted hustlers looking for new turf, but an entire lost and wandering nation. Litvak's plan was going to work because there was something about Mendel Spielmann that could make a man with a broken voice box want to speak. It was against the something in Spielmann that something in Litvak pushed back, revulsed. He felt an urge to crush that schoolboy hand in his own, to break the bones of it. "What's up, Yid?" the Lanceman said to Litvak. "Long time." Litvak nodded, and he shook the Lanceman's hand. He was torn, as he had always been, between his natural impulse to admire a competent practitioner of a difficult trade, and his suspicion that the woman was a lesbian, a human category that he failed almost on principle to understand. "All right, then," she said. She was still holding on to Spielmann, and as the wind picked up, she moved closer to him and put her arm around his shoulder, drawing him to her, giving him a squeeze. She scanned the greenish faces of the men who waited for her to hand over the cargo. "You going to be all right, then?" Litvak wrote in his pad and passed it to Raboy. "It's late," Raboy said, "and dark. Let us put you up for the night." She appeared to consider rejecting the offer for a long moment. Then she nodded. "Good idea," she said. At the bottom of the long, winding stair, Spielmann stopped to take in the particulars of the climb and the platform of the inclined elevator, and he seemed to suffer a qualm, a foreshock, a sudden access of understanding of everything that would from now on be expected of him. With a certain drama, he collapsed into Raboy's wheelchair. "I left my cape at home," he said. When they reached the top, he stayed in the chair and allowed the Lanceman to wheel him into the main building. The strain of travel, or the step he had finally taken, or the plummeting level of heroin in his bloodstream was beginning to tell. But when they reached the room on the ground floor that had been prepared for him, a bed, a desk, a chair, and a fine English chess set, he rallied. He reached into the pocket of his creased suit and took out a black and bright yellow cardboard package. "No, I understand a Mazeltov is in order," he said, passing out half a dozen fine-looking Cohiba cigars. The smell of them, even unlit and 3 feet from his nostrils, was enough to whisper promises to Litvak of well-earned respite, clean sheets, hot water, brown women, the quiet aftermath of brutal battles. "They tell me it's a girl." For a moment nobody knew what he was talking about, and then they all laughed nervously, except for Litvak and Turteltaub, whose cheeks turned the color of borscht. Turteltaub knew, as each of them knew, that Spielmann was not to be provided with any details of the plan, including the newborn heifer, until Litvak gave the order. Litvak knocked the cigar from Spielmann's soft hand. He scowled at Turteltaub, hardly able to see him through the blood-red broth of his own anger. The certainty he had felt down on the dock that Spielmann would serve their needs was turned abruptly on its head. A man like Spielmann, a talent like Spielmann's, could never serve anyone. It could only be served, above all by the one who wielded it. No wonder the poor bastard had been hiding from it for so long. "Out." They read his message and filed one by one out of the room, last of all the Lanceman, who made a point of asking where she would be sleeping and then of telling Mendel pointedly that she would see him in the morning. At the time Litvak had a vague idea she might be arranging a tryst, but his notion of her as a lesbian canceled it out before he had time to give it any consideration. It didn't occur to Litvak that the Jewess, in her readiness for any adventure, was already laying the groundwork for the daring escape that Mendel had not yet decided to attempt. The Lanceman struck a match, puffed at her cigar to get it lit. Then she sauntered out. "Don't hold it against the boy, Reb Litvak," Spielmann said when they were alone. "People have a way of telling me things. But I guess you noticed that. Please have a cigar. Go on. It's a very good one." Spielmann picked up the Corona that Litvak had knocked from his grasp, and when Litvak neither accepted nor refused it, the Yid lifted it to Litvak's mouth and fitted it gently between his lips. It hung there, exuding its smells of gravy and cork and mesquite, cuntish smells that stirred old longings. There was a click and a scrape, and then Litvak leaned wonderingly forward and poked the end of the cigar into the flame of his own Zippo lighter. He felt the momentary shock of a miracle. Then he grinned and nodded his thanks, feeling a kind of giddy relief at the belated arrival of a logical explanation. He must have left the lighter back in Sitka, where Gold or Turtletoib had found it and brought it along on the flight to Peril Strait. Spielman had borrowed it, and, with his junkie instincts, pocketed it after lighting a papyrus. Yes, good. The cigar caught with a crackle and flared. When Litvak looked back up from the glowing coal, Spielman was staring at him with those strange, mosaic eyes, flecks of gold and green. Good, Litvak told himself again. A very good cigar. Go ahead, Spielman said. He pressed the Zippo into Litvak's hand. Go, Reb Litvak. Light the candle. There's no prayer, you say. There's nothing you have to do or feel. You just light it. Go on. As logic drained away from the world, never entirely to return, Spielman reached into Litvak's jacket pocket and took out the glass and the wax and the wick. For this trick, Litvak could make himself no explanation. He took the candle from Spielman and set it on a table. He struck the flint with a scratch of his thumb. He felt the intense warmth of Spielman's hand on his shoulder, the fist of his heart begin to slacken its grip, the way it might when the day came that he finally set foot in the home where he was meant to dwell. It was a terrifying sensation. He opened his mouth. No, he said in a voice that had in it, to his wonder, a note of the human. He snapped the lighter shut and knocked Spielman's hand aside with such violence that Spielman lost his balance, stumbled, and hit his head on the metal shelf. The force of the blow jarred loose the candle and sent it crashing to the tile floor. The glass cracked into three large pieces. The cylinder of wax split in two.
I don't want it, Litvak croaked. I'm not ready.
But when he looked down at Spielman sprawled on the floor, dazed, bleeding from a cut on his right temple, he knew that it was already too late. 40. Just as Litvak lays down his pen, you can hear a tumult outside. Half a curse, glass breaking, the wind huffing out of somebody's lungs. Then Berko Shemets comes promenading into the bedroom. He has Gold's head nestled under one arm like a nice roast, and the rest of Gold dragging along behind. The Gonif's heels plow deep furrows in the carpet. Berko slams the door behind them. He has his sholem out, and it hungers like a compass needle for the magnetic north of Alter Litvak. Hertz's blood is mapped across Berko's hunting shirt and jeans. Berko's hat is pushed back in a way that makes his face look all brow and eye whites. The head of Gold glares oracular from the crook of Berko's arm. You should shit blood and pus, Gold intones. You should get scabies like Job. Berko's gun swings around to get a look at the young Yid's brain in its breakable container. Gold stops struggling, and the gun resumes its one-eyed inspection of Alter Litvak's chest. Berko, Lanzmann says, what's this craziness? Berko heaves his gaze toward Lanzmann like a great burden. He opens his lips, closes them, draws a breath. He seems to have something important that he wants to express, a name, a spell, an equation that can bend time or unknit the strings of the world. Or maybe he's trying to keep from coming unknit himself. That Yid, he says, and then softer, his voice a little husky. My mother. Lanzmann has maybe seen a photograph of Laurie Joubert. He manages to scare up a vague memory of teased black bangs, pinkish glasses, a wise-ass smile. But the woman is not even a ghost to him. Berko used to tell stories about life in the Indianer lands. Basketball, seal hunts, drunks and uncles, Willie Dick stories, the story of the human ear on the table. Lanzmann doesn't remember any stories about the mother. He supposes that he always knew there had to be some kind of cost to Berko in turning himself inside out the way he did, some kind of heroic feat of forgetting. He just never bothered to think of it as a loss, a failure of imagination, a worse sin in a shamus than going into a hot place with no backup. Or maybe it was the same sin in a different form. No doubt, Lanzmann says, taking a step toward his partner. Bad guy. Worth a bullet. You have two little boys, Berko, Bina says in her flattest tone. You have Esther Malka. You have a future not to throw away.
He does not, Gold says, or tries to say.
Berko puts a deeper squeeze on him, and Gold gags, trying to turn over, to gain purchase with his feet. Litvak scrawls something in the back of the pad without taking his eyes off of Berko.
"What is it?" Berko says. "What did he say?"
"No future here for any Jew."
"Yeah, yeah," says Lansman. "We get it already."
He grabs the pen and the pad away from Litvak. He flips over the last pages and writes in American, "Don't be an idiot. You're acting like me." He tears out the sheet of paper, then tosses the pad and pen back to Litvak. He holds the sheet up in front of Berko's face so that his partner can read it. It's a fairly persuasive argument. Berko lets go of Gold right as the Yid is turning a bruised color all over. Gold drops to the floor, gasping for breath. The gun in Berko's fist wavers.
"He killed your sister, Meyer."
"I don't know if he did or not," Lansman says. He turns to Litvak.
"Did you?"
Litvak shakes his head and starts to write something out on the pad, but before he finishes, a cheer goes up in the outer room. The heartfelt but self-conscious whoop of young men watching something great on television. A goal has been scored. A girl playing beach volleyball has fallen out of a bikini top. A moment later, Lansman hears the cheers echoing, the sound of it carried through the open window of the penthouse, as if on a wind from far away. The Harkavy, the Nachtassel. Litvak smiles and puts down the pad and pen with a strange finality, as if he has nothing left to say, as if his whole confession was leading to, was made possible by, only this moment. Gold crawls to the door, drags it open, and then staggers to his feet and into the outer room. Bina goes over to Berko and holds out her hand, and after a moment Berko lays the gun across her palm. In the outer room of the penthouse, the young believers hug one another and jump up and down in their suits. Their yarmulkes tumble from their heads. Their faces shine with tears. On the big television screen, Lansman gets his first look at an image that will soon be splashed across the front page of every newspaper in the world. All over town, pious hands will clip it and tape it to their front doors and windows. They will frame it and hang it behind the counters of their shops. Some hustler, inevitably, will work the thing up as a full-size poster, 2 feet by 3. The hilltop in Jerusalem, crowded with alleys and houses. The broad empty mesa of paving stone. The jagged jawbone of burnt teeth. The magnificent plume of black smoke. And at the bottom, the legend in blue letters, "At last." These posters will sell at the stationers for between $10 and $12.95.
Sweet God! What are they doing? What did they do?
There is a lot that shocks Lansman about the image on the television screen, but the most shocking thing of all is simply that an object 8,000 miles away has been acted upon by Jews from Sitka. It seems to violate some fundamental law of the emotional physics that Lansman understands. Sitka space-time is a curved phenomenon. A Yid could reach out in any direction as far as he was able and end up only tapping himself on the back.
"What about Mendel?" he says.
"I guess they were too far along to stop," Bina says. "I guess they just went ahead without him." It's perverse, but for some reason the thought makes Lansman feel sad on Mendel's behalf. Everything and everyone, from now on, will be going ahead without him. For a couple of minutes, Bina stands there watching the boys carry on, her arms folded, her face without expression except at the corners of her eyes. The way she looks reminds Lansman of an engagement party they went to years ago for a friend of Bina's. The bride-to-be was marrying a Mexican, and as a kind of joke, the party had a Cinco de Mayo theme. They hung a papier-mâché penguin from a tree in the yard. Children were blindfolded and sent forth, armed with a stick, to deal the penguin blows until it broke open. The children beat the penguin with savagery, and then the candy came showering down. It was just a bunch of wrapped toffees, peppermint, butterscotch, the kind your great-aunt could be relied upon to supply from a dusty crevice of her handbag. But as it rained from the sky, the children swarmed with a bestial joy, and Bina stood there watching them with her arms folded and a pleat at the corners of her eyes. She passes Berko back his shalom and unholsters her own.
"Shut up," Bina says, and then in American, "Shut the fuck up."
Some of the young men have taken out their chauffeurs and are trying to call people, but everyone in Sitka must be trying to call people. They show one another the error messages they are getting on their telephone screens. The network is busy. Bina goes over to the television and kicks its cord. The plug snaps out of the wall. The television sighs. Some dark fuel seems to drain from the young men's tanks when the television goes off. "You are under arrest," Bina says gently, now that she has their attention. "Go over and put your hands on the wall." "Meyer?" Lanzmann pats them down one by one, crouching like a tailor measuring an inseam. From the six along the wall, he collects 8 handguns and 2 expensive hunting knives. As he finishes with each one, he tells him to sit down. His third search recovers the Beretta that Berko lent him before he left for Yakovy. Lanzmann holds it up for Berko to enjoy.
"Little cutie," Berko says, keeping his big sholem level.
When Lanzmann is through, the young believers take their seats, 3 on the couch, 2 in a pair of armchairs, 1 in a dining chair pulled from an alcove. All at once, sitting in their chairs, they look young and lost. They are the runts, the ones that have been left behind. They turn as one, faces flushed, to the door of Litvak's bedroom, looking for guidance. The door to the bedroom is closed. Bina opens the door, then pushes it wide with a toe. She stands, looking in, for a full 5 seconds. "Meyer, Berko." The blind rattles in the wind. The bathroom door stands open, the bathroom dark. Alter Litvak is gone. They look in the closet. They look in the shower. Bina goes over to the rattling blind and jerks it high. A sliding glass door stands open, wide enough to admit an intruder, or an escapee. They go out onto the roof and look around. They search behind the air conditioner unit, and all around a water tank, and under a tarp that conceals a pile of folding chairs. They peer over the cornices. There is no shattered portrait of Litvak drawn in oils on the surface of the parking lot. They go back down to the penthouse of the Blackpool. In the middle of his cot lie Litvak's pen and pad and an ill-used gunmetal Zippo. Lanzmann picks up the pad to read the last words that Litvak wrote before he laid it down. "I didn't kill her. She was a good man." "They smuggled him out," Bina says. "Those bastards. Those bastard U.S. Army Ranger friends of his." Bina called to the men down around the hotel's doors. None of them saw anyone leave, nor anything unusual. For example, a squad of cold-faced warriors or repelling cables being lowered from a Black Hawk. "Bastards," she says again in American this time, and with greater heat. "Fucking Bible-thumping Yankee motherfuckers."
"Language, lady, jeez. Yeah, whoa, take it easy there, ma'am."
Some Americans in suits, a number of them, too many and too bunched up for Lanzmann to count accurately, call it 6, have arranged their shoulders in the doorway to the outer room. Big men, well-fed, loving their jobs. One wears a snappy olive-drab duster and an apologetic smile under his white gold hair. Lanzmann almost doesn't recognize him without the penguin sweater.
"Okay now," says the man who must be Cash Dollar. "Let's everybody try to calm down."
"FBI," says Berko.
"Close enough," says Cash Dollar.
41. Lanzmann pisses away the next 24 hours in the hum of a chalk-white room with a milk-white carpet on the 7th floor of the Harold Ickes Federal Building on Seward Street. In teams of 2, 6 men with the variegated surnames of doomed crewmen in a submarine movie rotate in and out of the room in 4-hour shifts. One is a black man and one a Latino, and the others are fluid pink giants with haircuts that occupy the neat interval between astronaut and pedophile scoutmaster. Gum chewers, overgrown boys with good manners and Bible school smiles. In each of them, at moments, Lanzmann sniffs out the diesel heart of a policeman, but he is baffled by the fairings of their southern and Gentile glamour. Despite the smokescreen of backtalk that Lanzmann puts up, they make him feel rattletrap, a 2-stroke old beater. No one threatens him or tries to intimidate him. Everyone addresses him by rank, taking care to pronounce Lanzmann's name the way he prefers. When Lanzmann turns surly, flippant, or evasive, the Americans display forbearance and schoolteacher poise. But when Lanzmann dares to give out with a question of his own,
An extinguishing silence rains down like 1,000 gallons of water dropped from a plane. The Americans will say nothing about the whereabouts or situation of Detective Shemitz or Inspector Gelbfish. They have nothing to say either about Alter Litvak's vanishing act, and they appear never to have heard of Mendel Spielman or Naomi Lanzmann. They want to know what Lanzmann knows or thinks he knows about U.S. involvement in the attack on the Kubat Asakra and about the perpetrators, principals, ancillaries, and victims of that attack. And they do not want him to know what they know, if anything, about any of that. They have been so well trained in their art that they are deep into the second shift before Lanzmann realizes that the Americans are asking him the same roughly 24 questions over and over, inverting and rephrasing and coming at them from odd angles. Their questions are like the fundamental moves of the 6 different chess pieces, endlessly recombined until they number with the neurons in the brain. At regular intervals, Lanzmann is provided with terrible coffee and a series of increasingly rigid apricot and cherry Danish. At one point, he is shown into a break room and invited to inhabit a sofa. The coffee and Danish rotate in and out of the chalk-white room of Lanzmann's brain while he jams his eyes shut and pretends to nap. Then it is time to go back to the steady white noise of the walls, the laminate tabletop, the squeak of vinyl under his ass. Detective Lanzmann. He opens his eyes and sees woozy black moire on brown. Lanzmann's cheekbone is numb from the pressure of the tabletop against it. He hoists his head, leaving behind a puddle of spit. A sticky filament connects his lip to the table, then snaps. "Ick," says Cash Dollar. He takes a little package of Kleenex out of the right pocket of his sweater and slides it across the table to Lanzmann, past an open box of Danish. Cash Dollar has on a new sweater, a dark gold cardigan, and front panels of coffee-brown suede, leather buttons, suede patches on the elbows. He's sitting upright on a metal chair, necktie knotted, cheeks smooth, blue eyes softened by attractive jet-pilot wrinkles. His hair is the precise gold of the foil in a package of Broadways. He smiles without enthusiasm or cruelty. Lanzmann wipes his face and the mess he made on the table during his nap. "Are you hungry? Would you like a drink?" Lanzmann says he would like a glass of water. Cash Dollar reaches into the left pocket of his sweater and takes out a small bottle of mineral water. He tips it on its side and rolls it across the table to Lanzmann. He is not a young man, but there is something boyishly serious about the way he aims the bottle and launches it and steers it with body English to its destination. Lanzmann uncaps the bottle and takes a swallow. He doesn't really care for mineral water. "I used to work for a man," Cash Dollar says. "The man who had this job before me. He had a lot of cute catchphrases he liked to drop into a conversation. It's kind of a common trait among people who do what I do. We come out of the military, you know. We come out of the business world. We tend to like our catchphrases. Shibboleths. That's a Hebrew word, you know. Judges, chapter 12. Are you sure you aren't hungry? I can get you a bag of potato chips, cup of noodles. There's a microwave." "No, thanks," Lanzmann says. "So, shibboleths. This man, my predecessor, he used to say, 'We are telling a story, Cash Dollar. That's what we do.'" The voice he adopts to quote his former superior is bigger and not as folksy as his own prim tenor twang. More pompous. "Tell them a story, Cash Dollar. That's all the poor suckers want." Only he didn't say suckers. "People who do what you do," Lanzmann says, "meaning what? Sponsor terrorist attacks on Muslim holy places? Start in with the Crusades all over again? Kill innocent women who never did anything but fly their small airplanes and try to help somebody out of a jam once in a while? Shoot defenseless junkies in the head? Excuse me, I forgot what it is you do, you people with your shibboleths." "First of all, detective, we had nothing to do with Menashe Spielman's death." He pronounces Spielman's Hebrew name, Menashe. "I was as shocked and puzzled by that as anybody. I never met the fellow, but I know he was a remarkable individual with remarkable abilities, and we are very much worse off without him. How about a cigarette?" He holds out an unopened package of Winston's. "Come on, I know you like to smoke. There you go." He produces a package of matches and passes them with the Winston's across the table. "Now, as for your sister, hey, listen, I am so very sorry about your sister. No, I really am, for what it's worth, and I suppose that's not a lot. You have my sincere apology on that. That was a bad call made by the man who preceded me in this job, the fellow I was just talking about. And he paid for it. Not with his life, of course. Cash Dollar bears his big square teeth. Maybe you wish he had. But he paid. He was wrong. The man was wrong about a lot of things. For one, sorry. He gives his head a gentle shake. But we aren't telling a story. No? The story Detective Lantzman is telling us, just like it is done from the beginning. We're part of the story. You. Me. The Book of Matches comes from a place in Washington, D.C. called Hogate Seafood at 9th and Main Avenue, Southwest. The very restaurant, if he remembers his history, in front of which Delegate Anthony Dimond, prime opponent of the Alaskan Settlement Act, was run down by a taxicab while chasing an errant rum bun into the street. Lantzman strikes a match. Jesus, he says, looking up cross-eyed over the flame. Jesus, too. Jesus is okay with me. I'm glad. He's okay with me, too. And Jesus wasn't keen on killing, on hurting people, on destruction. I know that. The Kubata Sacra was a fine old piece of architecture, and Islam is a venerable religion. And other than the fact that it's completely mistaken on a fundamental level, I have no quarrel with it, per se. I wish there was some way to do this job that didn't require taking such actions. But sometimes there isn't. And Jesus knew that. Whoso shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck, and that he were drowned in the depth of the sea. Right? I mean, those are Jesus' words. The man could be fairly harsh when he needed to be. He was kick-ass, Lantzman suggests. Yes, he was. Now, you might not credit the fact, but the end times are coming, and I, for one, very much look forward to seeing them come. But for that to happen, Jerusalem and the Holy Land have to belong to the Jews again. That's what it says in the book. Sadly, there is no way to do that without some bloodshed, unfortunately. Without a certain amount of destruction. That's just what is written, you know. But I am trying very hard, unlike my immediate predecessor, to hold all that down to the absolute minimum. For Jesus' sake and for the sake of my own soul and all our sakes. To keep things running clean. Hold this operation together until we have it sorted out over there. Lay us down some facts on the ground. You don't want anybody to know you're behind it. You people who do what you do. Well, but that's kind of our M.O., if you know what I mean. And you want me to keep my mouth shut. I know it's asking a lot. Just until you lay these facts down on Jerusalem, move some Arabs out and some Berbers in, rename a few streets. Just until we get some of that good old critical mass going, straighten out some of the noses this has put out of joint, and then get busy, you know, fulfilling what is written. Lantzman takes a swallow of mineral water. It's warm and tastes of the inside of the pocket of a cardigan. I want my gun and my badge, he says, and that's what I want. I love policemen, Cash Dollar says without much enthusiasm. I really do. He covers his mouth with one hand and takes a contemplative breath through his nostrils. His hand sports a manicure, but one thumbnail has been gnawed. It's going to get awfully Indian around here, mister. Just between you and me. You get your gun and badge back. You don't stand to hold on to them for very long. Tribal P won't be hiring too many Jew boys to serve and protect. Maybe not, but they'll take Berko. They aren't taking anyone who doesn't have the paper. Oh, yeah, Lantzman says. That's the other thing I want. You're talking about a lot of paper, Detective Lantzman. You need a lot of quiet. Indeed I do, Cash Dollar says. Cash Dollar studies Lantzman for a long second or two, and Lantzman understands from a certain alertness in the man's eyes, a look of anticipation, that there is a gun concealed somewhere on Cash Dollar's person, and an itch in his finger to go with it. There are more direct ways of keeping Lantzman's mouth shut than buying him off with a gun and some documentation. Cash Dollar gets up from the chair and returns it carefully to its place under the table. He starts to work his thumb into his teeth, but thinks better of it. If I could just get my Kleenex back. Lonsman tosses the package, but it goes awry and Cash Dollar fumbles the catch. The package of Kleenex splats down into the box of stale Danish, landing in a shiny patch of red jelly. Anger opens a seam in Cash Dollar's placid gaze, through which you can see the banished shades of monsters and aversions. The last thing he wants, Lonsman remembers, is any hint of a mess. Cash Dollar tweezes a Kleenex from the package and uses it to wipe the package off, then tucks the rest back into the safety of his right pocket. He fidgets the bottom button of his sweater back through its buttonhole, and in the brief tug of woolen waistband over hip, Lonsman spots the bulge of the sholem. Your partner, he tells Lonsman, has a great deal to lose. A very great deal. So does your ex-wife, a fact that they both recognize all too well. Maybe it's time you came to the same conclusion about yourself. Lonsman considers the things that remain his to lose. A pork pie hat, a travel chess set, and a Polaroid picture of a dead messiah. A boundary map of Sitka, profane, ad hoc, encyclopedic. Crime scenes and low dives and chokeberry brambles printed on the tangles of his brain. Winter fog that blankets the heat, summer afternoons that stretch endless as arguments among Jews. Ghosts of Imperial Russia traced in the onion dome of St. Michael's Cathedral, and of Warsaw in the rocking and sawing of a cafe violinist. Canals, fishing boats, islands, stray dogs, canneries, dairy restaurants. The neon marquee of the Baranov Theater reflected on wet asphalt. Colors running like watercolor as you come out of a showing of Wells's Heart of Darkness, which you have just seen for the third time, with the girl of your dreams on your arm. Fuck what is written, Lonsman says. You know what? All at once he feels weary of Ghanims and prophets, guns and sacrifices, and the infinite gangster weight of God. He is tired of hearing about the Promised Land and the inevitable bloodshed required for its redemption. I don't care what supposedly got promised to some sandal-wearing idiot whose claim to fame is that he was ready to cut his own son's throat for the sake of a harebrained idea. I don't care about red heifers and patriarchs and locusts, a bunch of old bones in the sand. My homeland is in my hat. It's in my ex-wife's tote bag. He sits down. He lights another cigarette. Fuck you, Lonsman concludes. And fuck Jesus, too. He was a pussy. Tick a lock, Lonsman, Cash Dollar says softly, miming the twist of a key in the hole of his mouth. 42. When Lonsman steps outside the Icky's building and fits his hat to his voided head, he finds that the world has sailed into a fog bank. The night is a cold, sticky stuff that beads up on the sleeves of his overcoat. Korchak Platz is a bowl full of bright mist, smeared here and there with the paw prints of sodium lamps. Half-blind and cold in his bones, he trudges along Monastir Street to Berlevi Street, and then over to Max Nordau Street, with a kink in his back and an ache in his head and a sharp throbbing pain in his dignity. The space recently occupied by his mind hisses like the fog in his ears, hums like a bank of fluorescent tubes. He feels that he suffers from tinnitus of the soul. When he drags himself into the lobby of the Zamenhof, Tenenbaum hands him two letters. One is from the board, informing him that the hearing into his conduct in the deaths of Zilberblatt and Fletterman has been scheduled for 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. The other letter is a communication from the hotel's new ownership. A Ms. Robin Navin of the Joyce Generali Hotel Group has written to inform Lonsman that exciting changes are afoot in the coming months for the Zamenhof, to be known as of January 1st as the Lexington Park Sitka. Part of the general excitement stems from the fact that Lonsman's monthly lease has been terminated, effective on December 1st. All of the pigeonholes behind the front desk contain long white envelopes, each one slotted with the same fatal bend sinister in 20-pound lead, except for the pigeonhole label 208. Nothing in that one. You heard about what happened? Tenenbaum says after Lonsman has returned from his epistolary journey into the bright Gentile future of the Hotel Zamenhof. I saw it on the television, Lonsman says, though the memory feels secondhand, fogged over, a construct that his interrogators implanted through persistent questioning. At first they said it was a mistake, Tenenbaum says, gold toothpick jiggling in a corner of his mouth. Some Arabs making bombs in a tunnel under the Temple Mount. Then they said it was deliberate. The ones fighting the other ones. Sunnis and Shiites? Maybe. Somebody got careless with a rocket launcher. Syrians and Egyptians? Whoever the president was on saying they might have to go in. Saying it's a holy city to everybody. That didn't take long, Lanzmann says. His only other piece of mail is a postcard advertising a deep discount on lifetime membership at a gym where Lanzmann worked out for a few months after his divorce. The suggestion was made at the time that exercise might help his moods. It was a good suggestion. Lanzmann can't remember if it proved correct or not. The card depicts a fat Jew to the left and a thin Jew to the right. The Jew to the left is haggard, sleepless, sclerotic, straggly, with cheeks like two spoonfuls of sour cream and two bright, mean little eyes. The Jew to the right is lean, tanned, and trim-bearded, relaxed, self-confident. He looks a lot like one of Litvak's young men. The Jew of the future, Lanzmann thinks. The unlikely claim is made by the postcard that the left-hand Jew and the Jew on the right are one and the same person. Did you see them out in the neighborhoods, Tenenbaum says, the golden pick clicking against the bicuspid, on the television? Lanzmann shakes his head. I imagine there was dancing. Such dancing, fainting, crying, a mass orgasm. Not on an empty stomach, I beg you, Tenenbaum. Blessing the Arabs for fighting with each other, blessing the memory of Mohammed. That seems cruel. One of these black hats was on there saying how he's going to move over to the land of Israel, get himself a good seat for when Messiah shows up. He removes the toothpick and surveys its tip for a hint of treasure, then returns it, disappointed. Ask me, I say, put all those nut jobs in a great big airplane. Send them all the hell over there. A black year on them. That what you say, Tenenbaum? I fly that airplane myself. Lanzmann stuffs the letter from the Joyce Generali Hotel Group back into its envelope and slides it across the counter to Tenenbaum. Toss that for me, would you? You have 30 days, detective, Tenenbaum says. You will find something. You bet I will, Lanzmann says. We'll all find something. Unless something finds us first, am I right? What about you? They're going to let you keep your job? My status remains under review. That sounds hopeful. Or hopeless. One or the other. Lanzmann takes the elevatoro to the fifth floor. He walks down the corridor, his overcoat slung on a crooked fingertip from one shoulder, loosening his necktie with the other hand. The door to his room hums its simple lyric, 505. It means nothing. Lights in the fog. Three Arabic numerals. Invented in India, actually, like the game of chess, but disseminated by Arabs. Sunnis, Shiites. Syrians, Egyptians. Lanzmann wonders how long it will take the various contending factions in Palestine to figure out that none of them was responsible for the attack. A day or two, maybe a week. Just long enough for terminal confusion to set in. Litvak to get his boys in place. Cash dollar to send in the air support. Next thing you know, Tenenbaum's working as the night manager of the Jerusalem Lexington Park. Lanzmann gets into bed and takes out the pocket chess set. His attention flits along the lines of force, hops from square to square in pursuit of the killer of Mendel Spielman and Naomi Lanzmann. Lanzmann finds, to his surprise and relief, that he already knows who the killer is. It is the Swiss-born physicist, winner of the Nobel Prize, and mediocre chess player, Albert Einstein. Einstein, with his fog of hair and his enormous sweater jacket, and his eyes like tunnels, reaching deep into the darkness of time itself. Lanzmann pursues Albert Einstein across the milk-white, chalk-white ice, hopping from square to shadowed square across relativistic chessboards of culpability and atonement, across the imaginary land of penguins and Eskimos that the Jews never quite managed to inherit. His dream makes a night move, and with characteristic fervor, his little sister, Naomi, begins to explain to Lanzmann Einstein's famous proof of the eternal return of the Jew, and how it can be measured only in terms of the eternal exile of the Jew, a proof that the great man deduced from observing the wobble in the wing of an airplane and the drift of a dark bloom of smoke rising from the slope of an ice mountain. Lanzmann's dream calves other slow iceberg dreams, and the ice hums with fluorescence. At some point the humming that has plagued Lanzmann and his people since the dawn of time, which some in their foolishness have mistaken for the voice of God, gets trapped in the windows of room 505 like sunlight in the heart of an iceberg.
Lanceman opens his eyes. In the seams of the Venetian blinds, daylight buzzes like a trapped fly. Naomi is dead again, and that fool of an Einstein is innocent of all wrongdoing in the Spielman case. Lanceman knows nothing at all. He feels an ache in his abdomen that he takes at first for sorrow before determining, a moment later, that what he's feeling is hunger. The desire, in fact, for stuffed cabbage. He checks his chauffeur for the time, but the battery has died. The day clerk reports, when Lanceman calls down to the desk, that it is 9:09 a.m., Thursday. Stuffed cabbage. Every Wednesday night is Romania night at the Vorst, and Mrs. Kolushiner always has something left over the next morning. The old bat serves the finest sarmali and sitka, at once light and dense, favoring hot pepper over sweet and sour, drizzled with fresh sour cream, topped with sprigs of fresh dill. Lanceman shaves and dresses in the same brown suit and a tie from off the doorknob. He is ready to consume his own weight in sarmali. But when he gets downstairs, he glances at the clock over the mail slots and realizes that he is 9 minutes late for his hearing before the review committee. By the time Lanceman comes scrabbling like a dog on slick tile down the corridor of the administration modular into room 102, he is 22 minutes late. He finds nothing but a long veneer table with 5 chairs, one for each member of the review board, and his commanding officer, sitting on the edge of the table, legs dangling, crossed at the ankle, her pointy-toed pumps aiming straight for Lanceman's heart. The 5 big high-backed leather chairs are empty. Bina looks like hell, only hotter. Her seagull-brown suit is rumpled and misbuttoned. Her hair appears to be tied back with a plastic drinking straw. Her pantyhose are long gone, her legs bare and dappled with pale freckles. Lanceman recalls with a strange pleasure the way she would trash a laddered pair of stockings, shredding them into a pompon of rage before tossing them into the can. "Stop looking at my legs," she says. "Cut it out, Meyer. Look at my face." Lanceman complies, staring right down the bores of her double-barreled gaze. "I overslept," he says. "I'm sorry. They kept me for 24 hours, and by the time..." "They kept me for 31 hours, she says. "I just got out." "So fuck me and my whining, for starters." "For starters. How was it by you?" "They were so nice," Bina says bitterly. "I totally folded, told them everything." "Same here." "So," she says, gesturing to the room around them with upturned hands, like she just made something disappear. Her jocular tone is not a good sign. "Guess what?" "I'm dead," Lanceman tries. "The board sprinkled me with quicklime and plowed me under." "As a matter of fact," she says, "I got a call on my mobile this morning in this room at 8:59. After I made a total ass of myself and screamed my head off until they let me out of the federal building so I could get down here and make sure I was in that chair behind you on time and ready to stand up and support my detective." "Your hearing was canceled." Bina reaches into her bag, rummages around, and comes out with a gun. She adds it to the battery comprising her rifled gaze and the toes of her pointed shoes. A chopped M39. A manila tag dangles on a string from its barrel. She arcs it toward Lanceman's head. He manages to catch the gun but fumbles the badge holder that comes flying after it. Then comes a little bag with Lanceman's clip. Another brief search of her bag produces a murderous-looking form and its triplicate henchmen. "After you go ahead and break your head on this DPD 2255, Detective Lanceman, you will have been reinstated with full pay and benefits as an active member of the District Police, Sitka Central Division." "I'm back on the job." "For, what is it, 5 more weeks? Enjoy." Lanceman weighs the shalom like a Shakespearean hero contemplating a skull. "I should have asked for $1 million, he says. "I'll bet he would have coughed it up." "God damn him," Bina says. "God damn them all. I always knew they were there, down there in Washington, up there over our heads, holding the string, setting the agenda. Of course I knew that. We all knew that. We all grew up knowing that, right? We are here on sufferance, house guests. But they ignored us for so long, left us to our own devices. It was easy to kid yourself, make you think you had a little autonomy in a small way. Nothing fancy. I thought I was working for everyone, you know, serving the public, upholding the law. But really, I was just working for Cash Dollar.
You think I should have been discharged, don't you?
No, Meyer. I know I go a little too far, play the hunches, the loose cannon routine.
You think I'm angry because they gave you back your badge and your gun?
Well, not so much that, no. But the hearing being canceled. I know how much you like things done by the book.
I do like things done by the book, she says, her voice tight. I believe in the book.
I know you do. If you and I had played it by the book a little more, she says, and something dangerous seems to well up between them. You and your hunches, a black year on them. He wants to tell it to her then, the story that has been telling him for the past 3 years, how after Django was husked from her body, Lanzmann stopped the doctor in the hall outside the operating room. Bina had instructed Lanzmann to ask this good doctor whether there was some use, some aim or study to which the half-grown bones and organs might be put. My wife was wondering, Lanzmann began, then faltered. Whether there was any visible defect, the doctor said. No, nothing at all. The baby appeared to be normal. He remarked, too late, the look of horror blooming on Lanzmann's face. Of course that doesn't mean there was nothing wrong.
Of course, Lanzmann said.
He never saw this doctor again. The ultimate fate of the little body, of the boy Lanzmann sacrificed to the god of his own dark hunches, was something he had neither the heart nor the stomach to investigate.
I made the same fucking deal, Meyer, Bina says before he can confess to her, for my silence.
That you get to keep being a cop?
No, that you do.
Thanks, Lanzmann says.
Bina, thanks a lot. I'm grateful.
She presses her face into her hands and massages her temples.
I'm grateful to you, too, she says. I'm grateful for the reminder of just how messed up all of this is.
My pleasure, he says. Glad I could help.
Fucking Mr. Cash Dollar.
The man's hair doesn't move. It's like it's welded to his head. He said he had nothing to do with Naomi, Lanzmann says. He pauses and nibbles on his lip. He said it was the man who had the job before him. He tries to keep his head up while he says it, but after a moment he finds himself looking at the stitches of his shoes. Bina reaches, hesitates, then gives his shoulder a squeeze. She leaves her hand on him for all of 2 seconds, just long enough to rip a seam or two in Lanzmann. Also, he denied any involvement in Spielmann. I forgot to ask him about Litvak, though. Lanzmann looks up, and she takes her hand away. Did Cash Dollar tell you where they took him? Is he on his way to Jerusalem?
He tried to look mysterious about it, but I think he was just without a clue. I overheard him on his cell phone telling somebody they were bringing in a forensic team from Seattle to go over the room at the Blackpool. Maybe that was something he wanted me to hear. But I have to say they all seemed nonplussed about our friend Alter Litvak. They seem to have no idea where he is. Maybe he took the money and ran. He could be halfway to Madagascar by now.
Maybe, Lanzmann says, then, more slowly,
maybe.
God help me, I sense another hunch coming on.
You said you're grateful to me.
In a backhanded, ironical way, yeah.
Look, I could use a little backup. I want to have another look at Litvak's room. We can't get into the Blackpool. The whole joint is under some kind of secret federal lockdown. Only I don't want to get into the Blackpool. I want to get under it.
Under it?
I heard there might be some tunnels down there.
Tunnels?
Warsaw tunnels, I heard they're called.
You need me to hold your hand, she says, in a deep, dark, nasty old tunnel.
Only in the metaphorical sense, he says.
43. At the top of the stairs, Bina takes a keyring flashlight from her cowhide bag and passes it to Lanzmann. It promotes or possibly allegorizes the services of a Yakovy funeral home. Then she moves aside some dossiers, a sheaf of court documents, a wooden hairbrush, a mummified boomerang that may once have been a banana in a Ziploc, a copy of People, and comes up with a slack, black harness suggestive of sadomasochistic sex play, equipped with a kind of round canister. She plunges her head into the midst of it and involves her hair with the black webbing. When she sits up and turns her head, a silver lens flares and wanes, raking Lanzmann's face.
Lanceman can feel the imminent darkness, can feel the very word tunnel burrowing through his ribcage. They go down the steps through the lost articles room. The taxidermy Martin leers at them as they pass. The loop of rope on the door of the crawl space dangles. Lanceman tries to recall if he returned it to its hook before his inglorious retreat last Thursday night. He stands there, racking his memory, and then he gives up. "I'll go first," Bina says. She gets down on her bare knees and works herself into the crawl space. Lanceman hangs back. His throbbing pulse, his dry tongue, his automatic systems are caught up in the tiresome history of his phobia. But the crystal set that is handed out to every Jew, tuned to receive transmissions from Messiah, resonates at the sight of Bina's ass, the long indented arc of it like some kind of magic alphabet letter, a rune with the power to roll away the stone slab behind which he has entombed his desire for her. He is pierced by the knowledge that no matter how potent a spell it still casts over him, he will never again find himself permitted, wonder of wonders, to bite it. Then it vanishes into the darkness along with the rest of her, and Lanceman is left stranded. He mutters to himself, reasons with himself, dares himself to go in after her, and then Bina says, "Get in here," and Lanceman obeys. She spans an arc of the plywood disc with her fingertips, lifts it, and passes it to Lanceman, her face flickering with the glow of his flashlight, and with a prankish solemnity he has not seen in years. When they were kids, he would climb to her bedroom in the night, sneaking in and out the window to sleep with her. And this was the face she wore as she eased up the sash. "It's a ladder," she says. "Meyer, you didn't go down this when you came here that night?" "Well, no, I wasn't really... "Yeah, okay," she says gently. "I know." She lowers herself down one steel cleat at a time, and again Lanceman goes after her. He can hear her grunt as she lets herself drop, the metallic scrape of her shoes. Then he falls down into the darkness. She catches hold of him and half succeeds in keeping him on his feet. The lamp on Bina's forehead splashes light here, 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 making a hasty sketch of the tunnel. It's another aluminum pipe, running perpendicular to the one they just came down. Lanceman's hat brushes against the arc of it when he stands erect. It ends behind them in a curtain of dank black earth and runs straight away from them, under Max Nordau Street, toward the Blackpool. The air is cold and planetary, with an iron taint. A floor of plywood has been laid, and as they clunk along it, their lights pick out the imprints of the boots of passing men. When they reckon themselves to be about halfway across Max Nordau, they meet another pipeline running away to the east and west, linking this tunnel to the network laid against the likelihood of future annihilation. Tunnels leading to tunnels, storehouses, bunkers. Lanceman considers the cohort of Yids who arrived with his father, those who were not broken by suffering and horror, but rather somehow resolved. The former partisans, the resistors, communist gunmen, left Zionist saboteurs, the rabble, as they were styled in the newspapers of the South, who showed up in Sitka after the war with their vulcanized souls and fought with polar bears like Herr Chemitz their brief, doomed battle for control of the district. They knew those bold and devastated men, knew as they knew the flavor of their tongues and their mouths, that their saviors would one day betray them. They walked into this wild country that had never seen a Jew and set about preparing for the day when they would be rounded up, sent packing, forced to make a stand. Then, one by one, these wised-up, angry men and women had been co-opted, picked off, fattened up, set against one another, or defanged by Uncle Hertz and his endless operations. "Not all of them," Bina says, her voice like Lanceman's, caroming off the aluminum walls of the tunnel. "Some of them just got comfortable here. They started to forget a little bit. They felt at home." "I guess that's how it always goes," Lanceman says. "Egypt, Spain, Germany. They weakened. It's human to weaken. They had their lives. Come on." They follow the planks until they come to another pipe that opens overhead, also fitted with cleats. "You go first this time," Bina says. "Let me check out your ass for a change." Lanceman hoists himself up to the lowest cleat and then mounts to the top. A swatch of weak light shows through a break or hole in the lid that caps this end of the pipe. Lantzman pushes against the hatch, and it shoves back, a thick sheet of plywood that doesn't budge or buckle. He puts his shoulder into it. "What's the matter?" Bina says from beneath his feet, her lamp wobbling into his eyes. "It won't move," Lantzman says. "There must be something on it, or..." He feels for the hole, and his hand brushes against something cold and rigid. He recoils, then his fingers return to work out the sense of an iron rod, a cable pulled taut. He shines his light. A rubberized cable, knotted and fed through the finger hole from the top side, then drawn tight and lashed to the topmost cleat of the ladder underneath. "What is it, Meyer? What did they do?" "They tied it shut behind them so that nobody could follow them back down," Lantzman says. "Tied it with a nice, big piece of string."
This ends Disc 9. The Yiddish Policeman's Union, Disc 10.
44. A Ganef wind has blown down from the mainland to plunder the Sitka treasury of fog and rain, leaving behind only cobwebs and one bright penny in a vault of polished blue. At 12:03, the sun has already punched its ticket. Sinking, it stains the cobbles and stucco of the plots in a violin-colored throb of light that you would have to be a stone not to find poignant. Lantzman, a curse on his head, may be a shamus, but he is no stone. Driving onto Verbov Island, coming west on Avenue 225, he and Bina catch strong whiffs at every corner of the bubbling tzimis that is cooking up all over town. The smell blows more intense and richer with both joy and panic on this island than anywhere else. Signs and banners announce the imminent proclamation of the Kingdom of David and exhort the pious to prepare for the return of Eretz Yisrael. Many of the signs look spontaneous, sprayed in dripping characters on bed linens and sheets of butcher paper. In the side streets, crowds of women and handlers yell at one another, trying to hold down or hyperinflate the price of luggage, concentrated laundry soap, sunscreen, batteries, protein bars, bolts of tropical-weight wool. Deeper into the alleys, Lantzman imagines, in the basements and doorways, a quieter market burns like a banked fire. Prescription drugs, gold, automatic weapons. They drive past huddled groups of street-corner geniuses spinning commentary on which families are to be given which contracts when they reach the Holy Land, which of the wise guys will run the policy rackets, the cigarette smuggling, the gun franchises. For the first time since Geistick took the championship, since the World's Fair, maybe for the first time in 60 years or so it feels to Lantzman, something is actually happening in the Sitka district. What that something will turn out to be, not even the most learned of the sidewalk rebbes has the faintest idea. But when they reach the heart of the island, the faithful replica of the lost heart of old Verbov, there is no hint of the end of exile, rampant price gouging, messianic revolution. Down at the wide end of the plots, the house of the Verbova Rebbe stands looking solid and eternal as a house in a dream. Smoke hastens like a remittance from its lavish chimney, only to be waylaid by the wind. The morning's Rudashevskis loiter darkly at their posts, and on the ridge of the house, the black rooster perches, coattails flapping, with his semi-automatic mandolin. Around the plots, women describe the ordinary circuits of their day, pushing strollers, trailing girls and boys too young for school. Here and there they stop to knit and unravel the skeins of breath that tangle them together. Scraps of newsprint, leaves, and dust get up impromptu games of dreidel in the archways of the houses. A pair of men in long coats leans into the wind, making for the Rebbe's house, sidelocks swinging. For the first time, the traditional complaint, tantamount to a creed, or at least a philosophy, of the Sitka Jew, "Nobody gives a damn about us, stuck up here between Huna and Hatzaplatz," strikes Lantzman as having been a blessing these past 60 years, and not the affliction they had all, in their backwater of geography and history, supposed. "Who else is going to want to live in this chicken coop?" Bina says, echoing his thought in her own fashion, zipping her orange parka up past her chin. She slams the door of Lantzman's car and trades ritual glares with a gathering of women across the lane from the boundary maven's shop. "This place is like a glass eye. It's a wooden leg. You can't pawn it."
In front of the somber barn, the bachelor torments a rag with a broom handle. The rag is sloshed in solvent with a psychotropic odor, and the boy has been exiled to three hopeless islands of automobile grease on the cement. He jabs and caresses the rag with the end of his pole. When he takes note of Bina, he does so with a satisfying mixture of horror and awe. If Bina were Messiah, come to redeem him in an orange parka, the expression on the Pisha's face would be more or less the same. His gaze gets stuck to her, and then he has to detach it with brutal care, like someone removing his tongue from a frozen pump. "Reb Zimbalist," Lonsman says. "He's there," says the bachelor, nodding toward the door of the shop. "But he's really busy."
"As busy as you."
The bachelor gives the rag another desultory poke. "I was in the way." He makes the citation with a flourish of self-pity, then aims a cheekbone at Bina without implicating any of his other features of his face in the gesture. "She can't go in there," he says firmly. "It isn't appropriate."
"See this, sweetness?" Bina has fished out her badge. "I'm like a cash gift. I'm always appropriate."
The bachelor takes a step backward, and the mop handle disappears behind his back as if somehow it might incriminate him. "Are you going to arrest Reb Itzik?" he says. "Now," Lonsman says, taking a step toward the bachelor, "why would we want to do that?" One thing about a yeshiva bachelor, he knows his way around the question. "How should I know?" he says. "If I was a fancy-pants lawyer, tell me, please, would I be standing out here slopping around with a rag on the end of a stick?" Inside the shop, they have gathered around the big map table, Itzik Zimbalist and his crew, a dozen strapping Jews in yellow coveralls, their chins upholstered with the netted rolls of their beards. The presence of a woman in the shop flits among them like a bothersome moth. Zimbalist is the last to look up from the problem spread out on the table before him. When he sees who has come with the latest thorny question for the boundary maven, he nods and grunts with a suggestion of huffiness, as if Lonsman and Bina are late for their appointment. "Good morning, gentlemen," Bina says, her voice weirdly fluting and unpersuasive in this big male barn. "I'm Inspector Gelbfish." "Good morning," says the boundary maven. His sharp and fleshless face is illegible as a blade or a skull. He rolls up the plan or chart with practiced hands, ties it in a length of cord, and turns to sheath it in the rack, where it disappears among a thousand of its fellows. His movements are those of an old man to whom haste is a forgotten vice. His step is herky-jerk, but his hands mannered and accurate. "Lunch is over," he tells the crew, though there is not a trace of food to be seen. The men hesitate, forming an irregular eruv around the boundary maven, ready to shield him from the secular trouble that stands hung with a couple of badges in their midst. "Maybe they'd better stick around," Lonsman says. "We might need to talk to them, too." "Go wait in the vans," Zimbalist tells them. "You're in the way." They start across the supply area to the garage. One of the crew turns back, pressing doubtfully at the roll of his beard. "Seeing as how lunch is over, Reb Itzik," he says, "is it all right with you if we have our supper now?" "Eat your breakfast, too," Zimbalist says. "You're going to be up all night." "Lot of work to do," Bina says. "Are you kidding? It's going to take them years to pack up this mess. I'm going to need a cargo container." He goes to the electric tea kettle and begins to set up three glasses. "No, Lonsman? I heard maybe you lost the use of that badge of yours for a little while," he says. "You hear a lot, don't you?" Lonsman says. "I hear what I hear. Have you ever heard that people dug tunnels all under the Unterstadt? Just in case the Americans turned on us and decided to stage an action?" "I'd say it rings a bell," Zimbalist says, "now that you mention it. So you wouldn't happen to possess by any chance a plan of those tunnels, showing how they run, where they connect, etc.?" The old man still has his back to them, tearing open the paper envelopes that hold the tea bags. "If I didn't," he says, "what kind of a boundary maven would I be? So if, for whatever reason, you wanted to get somebody, say, into or out of the basement of the Hotel Blackpool on Max Nordau Street without being seen, could you do that?"